The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Welcome back once again. This is Mark Steiner. We're going to be joined again by the two men who we met because of the op-ed piece they wrote in the New York Times, Aziz Abu Sara and Dimi Rader. Aziz Abu Sara is a Palestinian, a resident of both Jerusalem and Washington, D.C. He writes for the Al-Quds newspaper. He's co-executive director of the Center for World Religions, Diplomacy, and Conflict Resolution at George Mason University. And is now runs these alternative trips to the Middle East, and he's on one now. He's joining us from the Galilee. Dimi Rader is a journalist and photographer. He works from Israel and the Palestinian territories. His work has appeared in the New York Times, The Guardian, Foreign Policy, Haaretz, The Jerusalem Post, Index on Censorship, and has been quoted widely throughout in many newspapers throughout the world. And Aziz and Dimi, welcome. Good to have you both with us once again.
Great to be back. Thank you.
So I've been reading a lot of commentary on the mass demonstrations taking place in Israel, and they've been very fascinating. And some people have complained in some of the articles I've read, especially from the left, that nobody is talking about the occupation in these demonstrations. Others are saying that this has unique possibilities because it is radicalizing Israelis who otherwise would not be radicalized, and being radicalized, realizing that their country has been kind of taken over by this oligarchy of wealth they're being left out of. And I wonder how you both politically see, in that context, these demonstrations from those two points of view, really in some senses on extreme ends. Let me start with you, Aziz.
Well, I think for Palestinians especially, and for some of the people on the left, yes, they want to see more of the occupation brought up. And I think in the long run, keeping the occupation out of this will be impossible, and keeping the taking political lines will be impossible. In the short term, they are avoiding to talk about, as you mentioned, about the occupation, because they want to unify as many people as possible. Why I think it will be impossible to keep it like this, because political events are happening, and the government is trying to use political events. The fact that in the last 2 weeks, Netanyahu approved, or the government approved, two settlement growths, both in East Jerusalem and in Ariel, tells you that they're using, actually, these protests for political gains. They're using these protests so they can grow settlements. And I think it's really sad to see that the disconnection between the Israeli people who are in Tel Aviv and Haifa and all these cities saying, we want to live in these cities too, we don't want to move to the West Bank, and the government saying the solution we're offering you at the moment is building more in settlement. The solution that the Knesset offered last week ago is proposing more building in settlements of 40 Knesset members. The solution that's coming up from the government is really disconnected from the reality, and at one point, the people in these protests are going to have to face that reality that the government's not interested in their welfare. It's interested in whatever its agenda on. And Bibi Netanyahu seems to think settlements is the answer for everything.
And Dimi?
Yeah. No, I mean, I absolutely agree. I think that political events will catch up with the protests. And I agree, of course, that the government so far is trying to use the protests to promote the agenda it would be promoting anyway. My comfort is that it's not earning them any points with the protesters. In fact, it's just making them more angry. And we can see that kind of gradually changing, you know, in terms of radicalization. You can see every day new people coming up to the protest and beginning to talk about, first of all, about the economy. And they say, yeah, you know, we don't want a revolution. We just don't want to pay such high rent. Usually within like 2 hours, they begin talking, actually, we need to bring down that government. And within 24 hours, they're beginning to say, actually, the system as it works right now is fundamentally unrepresentative. In Israel, we have these national elections that there are primary elections within parties, and people run in these primary elections. And eventually what you get is a bunch of parties with a list of members who don't really have a specific affiliation or loyalty to a certain district, for instance, like you do in the United States. They're just kind of like party functionaries. It's all about internal party politics. And I think this is something where people are beginning to connect to the issue of the occupation. There was a film screening a few days ago, and it was about the occupation and about specifically the military court system, and how Israeli courts, while keeping some check on army violence, has also enabled and legitimized confiscation of Palestinian land for the settlement. And the film showed Palestinians standing by the side of the road, and some journalist asking them, what's happening here? And they say, we don't know. And he says, well, they're confiscating your land. And they say, yeah, but I mean, we don't know who to talk to. We don't make the rules, and we don't know who makes the rules and how we get to influence them. And the director speaking to the protesters after screening his film, he said that he thought he found some echoes of that feeling of underrepresentation in both the Palestinians in the film and the Israelis banging on the doors of the Knesset and trying to persuade their elected representatives to listen to what they say instead of using the protest for their own political gain. So I think that the occupation will begin to step in not only through the political event, but through like basic common sense issues of justice, decency, and things that people can understand on either side.
So I wonder if then in the long run, if you both see that this demonstration, where do you see this going? I mean, clearly this is spontaneous. It's not part of any mass organization or any organization at all. It's got tents that are being pitched across Israel. The demonstrations are that represent. We can talk a little bit about it again. The 1948 tent. There are all these other tents that are being pitched. Some Palestinian Israelis, Arab Israelis are participating. And I'm just curious. So, what do you think the significance of this will be? What do you think it's going to? Where is this going to go? I mean, what's your? You've wandered through these, Demi and Aziz. You've been following them very closely. Where do you think this is going to go? What will be its import?
I think it's
go ahead, Demi.
I think it's going. It's developing in several directions. I mean, first of all, like you said, there are now more and more Palestinian Israelis joining the protest. At least I can think of at least 8 camps in Arab Israeli towns and villages and areas. So it's becoming more and more of a real kind of nationwide protest. I mean, not nation in the sense of like the Jewish nation, but nation in the geographical sense of like everybody who lives here and they're affected by the system. Although this, of course, does not yet include the Palestinians beyond the green line. It's becoming more organized in the sense that they have now a system in which every new camp that's set up has to send 2 appointed or elected or whatever they like delegates to a regional assembly. And the regional assembly sends, each regional assembly sends 2 delegates to a nationwide coordination committee. And this committee needs to meet openly in one of the camps every week.
Huh.
And in there you have the regional delegates, you have representatives of the student union, you have a couple of representatives from the other movements, and you have the representatives of the original group who pitched the tent. But this is like a decentralized, horizontal form of leadership, because everything is arrived at by consensus, and all meetings are open to everyone. Now, in parallel to that, they've set up a committee, several committees of experts, who will advise the movement on positions they should take about the government's proposals, but more importantly about the structure of government, the structure of the economy in general. And they're saying that, again, that these committees are also open to everyone. And they're saying that we're not going to, this has gone too far already for us to settle, I don't know, for, you know, some cut on the VAT or some housing benefits. We want to change the system from the core. So they're really kind of digging in, and they're really trying to work on something very long-term and very fundamental.
And Aziz, how do you see it?
Yeah, I agree with Dini. I think there is some potential for a large political reform within Israel, and that's a good thing. And in many ways, what's going to happen is one of two. Either this movement's going to be able to mobilize and create a new system, create a new political structure in Israel, and in many ways create also a new political parties. That because the current parties, the opposition within Israel today is not the answer. Tzipi Livni party is not the Kadima, the second largest, or actually the largest party at the moment in the Knesset, still in the opposition, is not the answer, and most protesters know that. They're not looking for the opposition. So the only option they have at this moment is looking at creating something new, not just as a party, but probably also as a whole, a new movement, a new system. So, and the other hand, I want to say that also where it could go, and this is less maybe talked about, is reforming the relationship between the Arab and Jewish communities, the Palestinian Jewish communities within Israel. The fact that 30,000 people in Haifa demonstrated, both Palestinian citizens of Israel and Jews together, had them speaking together, people who spoke Arabic at the demonstration, people cheering for people talking about, for the speakers talking about Arabs and Jewish together, I think that's a major change. And for the Arab community, what they're looking for is equal treatment. I think this is slowly has becoming something more and more Palestinians within Israel saying, maybe we can use this movement, be part of it, to gain those rights. And for me, walking through the tent city, and I watched how many more Arab tents have been put recently. There's a group from Jaffa that I saw yesterday that have some tents. There's the 1948 group tent. And to see more and more Palestinians joining, both in Haifa, in Tel Aviv, and in Beersheba, is really inspiring.
And when as you walk through these tents, Aziz, and saw these tents, what were, I'm curious, what conversation you had with both Jewish and Palestinian people who were in those tents, and what the people from Jaffa in 1948 or other places said to you.
It's really interesting because it's stuff I would never have expected, let's say, a couple months ago. When I talked to a lot of the Jewish community two months ago, Bibi Netanyahu had pretty good popularity. Even people who didn't like him so much thought he was doing okay. He was doing fine. Israel had, you know, it was kind of sold that Israel has a great economic situation worldwide, and he saved Israel from the recession. Therefore, he was viewed very well. He stood up to the American president. And yesterday and the day before, when I walked around, I talked to people who really saw him, people who not necessarily from the left, the traditional left, and who really saw him in a new way. I was talking to one guy who comes from a Middle Eastern Jewish background, and he was telling me how he thought Mubarak, Assad, and Netanyahu are totally the same. They just use so different tools. And that was interesting. He said, Mubarak and Assad, they will shoot people and kill them. Bibi Netanyahu is a little bit better. He starves us to death. So to hear that was, to me, a surprising thing, especially from people who would normally actually vote for him. On the Palestinian side, people who I've seen and met were there seeing themselves actually, the ones who did come to the tent and say they want to feel that they are part of a national movement. They want to feel that this is also their country and their state, and that they can fight for a social justice. There was one sign says, if social justice, then let it be for all. And that's the message that a lot of Palestinian citizens of Israel that joining these protests are saying, you know, we've been suffering of this for a long time. And since we're talking about it, let's not talk about it only about the Jewish population. Let's not talk about only Tel Aviv, but let's talk about our rights as well to be equal to everybody in this state.
And do you think, Dimi, you wrote something earlier, a week or so ago, that this J-14 may mean something even deeper than the occupation and of a deeper symptom of some problems that could create some unity. And I know that when any of us can get caught up in a demonstrations like this, when it's just the spontaneous movement of hundreds of thousands of people, it can sometimes cloud our analytical thinking. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
because you're just caught up in the moment. But which is just natural. And we all do that. So but I wonder, when you wrote this piece about that the occupation being part of a bigger problem, what has changed or stayed the same in your analysis as you've wandered through the camps talking to people, the tent cities?
Well, I mean, what I'm seeing in the camps is, first of all, this was like the least euphoric and exuberant draft of the article. I had one of the editors went through and made it sound much more analytical than it was originally written. So, but yeah, I mean, walking through the camps and browsing through the online conversation, a lot of these camps are, they're communicating through Facebook and they set up their own chat site that's open to everyone. And hearing people talk, I think that's kind of I don't want to claim like some kind of copyright over this analysis. It's been said by many analysts before me that separation is a core function of the situation in Israel-Palestine. Separation goes into many, many ways. It goes between Arabs and Jews, but also goes within the Palestinian community, between, for instance, refugees and people who never left their homes, and villagers and city dwellers. And in Israel, it goes between the religious and secular Jews, and Jews according to the country of origin of their parents. And obviously, you have also the class divide. So there's like a very complicated like network of borders and walls that fragment society and help people blame each other rather than the government or the big business interests. And all these walls are becoming a lot less relevant in the past few weeks. I mean, it is kind of, and I've heard that people say the same thing about the Egyptian revolution, that when you were in Tahrir, it didn't matter if you were from one of the wealthiest quarters of Cairo or somebody from one of the poorest villages outside the city, that you could sit down and talk to anyone. And we see that in the camps, that people are openly conversing with people they never thought that they would talk to before, most certainly not cooperating something political. So, I mean, it's now obviously it's not a kind of a deliberate plan by somebody that this is how we will bring down all separation. It's happening because people have a common interest and a common goal. Because even with the vast economic differences, it is a fact that it's too expensive for middle class Jews to live here, and it's also too expensive for working class Jews to live here, and it's also too expensive for middle class Palestinian Israelis to live here. They all share that frustration and the feeling that they only work to survive, that they don't work to build a future for themselves. And beyond that, and then it goes beyond that. It goes into the issues of justice in general, and about having recourse with the government. So yeah, I think it's I stand behind my optimistic analysis.
Well, good. I mean, I think many people hope that's right. That this is a bubbling up that. Inspired by Tahrir Square, inspired by Tunisia, seeing Jewish, Christian, and Muslim Israelis out together is an amazing sight that no one expected. But I then, come a month from now, maybe less, the Palestinian Authority is calling for, as you've been writing about, Aziz, calling for massive, nonviolent demonstrations in support of Palestinian statehood.
Yes.
And if and when that occurs, and if these massive nonviolent demonstrations that grow out of the nonviolent demonstrations that took on the building of the wall and other things and the settlements, this could have not just a profound effect on Palestinians, but also on this movement that has sprouted spontaneously inside of Israel, Aziz.
That's absolutely true, and I think that these are the cards that Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, is relying on. He's hoping that by the time September comes, and especially if any of these protests can turn violent and it goes into a mass violent situation, then you're going to call the reserves, and these people who are protesting are going to be asked to go serve in the military at that moment, and that the whole protest will fall apart. And I think that's one that's a message we've heard from different people within the government. They're not even hiding it. Ehud Barak, Israel's defense minister, has said that, yes, these are good demands, and I agree with a lot of them. But at the same time, these people, the moment we call them from for reserves, they're going to all show up because they love this country, and they're not going to reject service in the military because of it. So I think that's something that the protesters are going to have to face, and it's one probably of the main challenges. In some ways, it's interesting. They're trying to form a lot of their positions way before September in preparation for September and trying to figure out how they're going to deal with it. But that's one thing. The other thing that Netanyahu can do at the moment is bring an end to the issue of Shalit's kidnapping by Hamas. And if he's able to come to a deal, and it looks like a deal is possible, Khaled Mishal, the head of Hamas, traveled to Cairo today to discuss this issue with the Egyptian authorities. If that happens, that would raise a lot in his popularity and might weaken the protesters' stance. So he has a few cards he could play, and in some ways some could be cynical and say he's hoping for a violent outcome of September, because that will take away the attention from the social justice movement towards, we have to protect the country, the Palestinians are attacking us. And I think even if it's a nonviolent movement, it's if two, three people get killed, that could generate certain violence, and that's, that could be the hope for the government.
I mean, and
yeah. I think, yeah, if I can just maybe add to that. That it does look like Netanyahu is going to, we actually mentioned, I think, in our report that one of the possibilities for Netanyahu to try and buy some popularity is to bring Gilad Shalit home and release the 1,000 Palestinian prisoners that Hamas is requesting in exchange. I'm really hopeful that he goes for that, not only because there are 1,001 people who deserve to be home, but because one of the major movements that have been taking place in Israel in the past few years was the Gilad Shalit campaign. It was a very, you can say it was in some way a precursor to this movement, because it was also like decidedly apolitical. In fact, this was its weakness. They advocated for Gilad Shalit to be brought home, but they never spoke explicitly about how they proposed to do that. But they did some impressive stuff. They had like a 5 minutes national break for Gilad, where people went out of their homes and cars and stood on highways and in major city streets. They managed to gather mass demonstrations. And a lot of the people who became slowly politicized through that campaign are now taking part in J14. And I think that if Netanyahu actually does complete the deal, it might show Israelis that there's actually nothing that they cannot do. We've been told for 5 years that that the Hamas is stubborn, that the prisoners that need to be released are too dangerous, and that anyway we have security experts dealing with the problem and holding the negotiations. If the people actually see that this soldier can be brought home through popular pressure, I think it's going to reinvigorate the movement massively. I don't think it's a kind of a very dangerous card for Netanyahu to play.
So in the midst of this, I have to ask you both, because it's the last piece, I'm very curious if you are, because I think anybody who is passionate about what goes on in between Palestinians and Israelis and has been involved in that at any length of time in their lives goes through periods of elation and hope, and then if nothing, for want of a better term, a deep psychic depression as you watch things unfold. So I'm curious where both of you are right now. I mean, what is your assessment of how you feel the immediate future will be?
Aziz, you go first.
Okay. Yes, I think we do. Absolutely. We have periods. I have periods where I open the newspaper in the morning and read what's happening, and or get phone calls and know what's happening. You get depressed. My brother was killed in the conflict. I had 4 cousins killed in the conflict, and it's a continuing thing. We're not in a post-conflict situation, so there are moments where you feel hopeless and nothing is happening. But at the same time, I think I search always for reasons to see hope, because we don't have any other alternative. If you give up on hope, then you're not going to do anything. And I can't live with that. And so my only alternative, I'm against violence, and so my only alternative is finding a way for both Palestinians and Israelis to coexist together in one solution or another. I do not have a strong opinion for what exact solution it needs to be, but I think for us to coexist in a viable situation, a just solution, I think that gives me strength to keep going on. That's why, regardless of my criticisms of the movement, of this social justice movement, and I can look at the occupation issue and say, I'm not happy with how it's going or they're going, it is an inspiring thing for me. It's inspiring always to see people go out, to see people stand for what they believe, to see Arabs and Jews especially willing to do that together, and to see Israelis inspired by the Arab strength, to me is really an amazing thing. So I heard yesterday of a doctor who said he felt ashamed not going out to protest, seeing the Syrians going out nonviolently week after week after week, day after day after day, getting shot for what they want and for their rights. And for him, he said to stay home and do nothing, just he felt ashamed to do that. And I think that's what gives me hope at the moment.
Jimmy.
You know, I second that emotion. It's a very, I mean, you know, I've been kind of politically active and then as a journalist for the past 10 years. And for the past 10 years, it felt as if things were growing steadily worse. In fact, there was just a few months ago, there was just a general atmosphere of doom and gloom that people were talking about leaving the country. I myself am going away in September for a year's studies in London, which is something that I've been wanting to do for a while. And for the first time in years, I feel like I don't want to leave. Like, I want to be here and be part of what's happening and help it along. So there's a lot of exuberance and a lot of, regardless of what it's going to achieve, just seeing people get out of their, like, usual circles and working together and, you know, seeing one of the most beautiful things you can see in life, I think, is seeing two and two people come together and produce something that's three, you know, that they're more than the sum of their parts. And see it happening across barriers is just amazing. But, you know, I also have a lot of apprehension about September. There are a million things that can go badly wrong there in every possible direction. And I just really, really hope that the thing that's happening here will overcome this looming deadline. But on the whole, I think it's a very good time to be here.
Well, I want to thank both of you, both for your work, your writing, your efforts for peace, and joining us here today, Dimi Rader and Aziz Abu Sara. Thank you both so much, and we look forward to continuing our conversation with the two of you over the coming weeks and months.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you for having us.
Thank you both. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.